Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today it's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Morning, Mark.
Good morning.
866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Boy, that nor'easter had some pretty wild winds, and that usually means bringing in some interesting birds. And what are we seeing? Some interesting seabirds brought in with that, with the nor'easter?
Yeah, so this was a highly anticipated storm if you're a weather watcher or a bird watcher. Anytime you have a nor'easter, and this is an interesting time of year to have one, because there's certain species that are out in the Gulf of Maine that you would not normally have access to that could be brought in. It was setting up kind of weird where the winds were just going to stay northeast. It seemed like it was one of those ones that was just going to park out there and like an unwanted guest just kind of overstay its welcome over several days. We've had a couple of those. But typically you want the storm to blow northeast, load up Cape Cod Bay with seabirds, and then the winds switch around to the northwest typically as they pass on. And things kind of dry out, and then you can go to First Encounter Beach in Eastham is the classic place to go post-storm, the day after, when the winds are still strong and the winds are blowing the birds up against the beach as they try to exit the bay. So they're flying east, kind of following the shoreline, trying to find their way back out to the open ocean. And it just presents a rare opportunity to see these birds up close that are normally like out in the Gulf of Maine, birds like Pommeran Jaeger that, you know, you might see a few at Race Point, but you can see hundreds in storms like this. And sure enough, the day after the strong part of the storm, it was still sort of blowing north, a little bit east maybe, but not northwest like typical, but that was enough. And the bay had apparently been loaded up with birds, and they were trying to get out. And the birders amassed at First Encounter Beach that next morning. We were sort of power refugees wandering around with the family looking for electricity. I totally missed out on it. It was quite a show for the birders. They had hundreds of red phalaropes, which is a really obscure little sandpiper, because you just don't see them. You don't see them skittering along on the beach. The average person, like, what's a phalarope? What an exotic sounding name. They're really
exactly
cool
what I was
birds.
Thinking, yeah.
Yes. They're really cool birds. Come on, Mindy, after all these years. But they're a sandpiper. They nest in the Arctic like all the other sandpipers that we see coming through here, but they're weird in a number of ways. The females are the colorful ones, and the males take care of the nests. And, you know, they're just, you know, they're very progressive birds. And But they have this strange dual lifestyle, like some of the Arctic birds, where they become open ocean birds for most of the year. And so after they breed up on the Arctic tundra, they head out over the ocean. And you would typically only see them from a boat. And hundreds of them just streamed by First Encounter that morning, along with several hundred Pommeran Jaegers. And so that was very exciting for birders. But then there were rare things. There was a brown booby, which makes no sense. That's not something you would have expected even 10 years ago in one of these storms, because this is like a cold season storm blowing out of the north. And here's this brown booby, which is something you would normally see sitting on a buoy off Key West. This is a warm water bird. And they've just been increasing for reasons, you know, the waters are getting warmer, certainly, but I'm not sure that why that would mean that they're coming up here. but there were two seen that day, one, a young one at Race Point and an adult at First Encounter. And then this big brutish seabird called a skua. And the birders are always hoping to see one of these. They're like Jaegers on steroids, and the Jaegers are already pretty brutish. They're big,
say,
tough,
wow,
fast.
That's something.
Yes, right. They could beat up a Jaeger. And so the Jaegers are chasing birds and stealing their food. And the skuas are just taking everybody's lunch. They're, you know, they can harass a gannet. And if you know how big a gannet is, I mean, that's like a B-52 bomber of a seabird out there, and a skua will go after them. And the other aspect of the rarities this time of year are the rare migrant songbirds and vagrants, things that end up here that shouldn't be here. At Fort Hill is like the classic place. You think, if you've been there, I always, even if you're not into birds, Fort Hill is one of the best unsung best views in Massachusetts. It's just a
Beautiful,
gorgeous place. You're
gorgeous.
at the top of this hill that's overlooking acres and acres of salt marsh and barrier beach and open ocean, and very cool place. But all of those habitats, the grassland, the salt marsh, the woods, the ocean being right there, just makes it a great place for interesting land birds that end up out over the ocean and land there or whatever, just hanging out in the thickets. And there's just one drab, obscure little songbird that has just kind of settled in as like the rarity of Fort Hill the last 6 years or something like that. It's called a Bell's Vireo. And no one's heard of it. If you're not a birder, you've not heard of a Bell's Vireo. They don't breed any closer than the Midwest. But for whatever reason, maybe it's the same individual that shows up at Fort Hill, and then just waits for somebody to find it. It doesn't make it easy. They're quiet at this time of year. They're not singing. They might give a quick little call, but they just skulk in the thickets and they're gray. But there are a lot of good birders that hang out at Fort Hill, like Tim Spar. He lives right there now, and I think he found this one, or he definitely refound it the other day, and so now everybody's seeing it by that lower parking lot. And then people find other stuff. I'm expecting more rarities there. Just all of those eyes being there, people will find more things. But
Yeah, and as you I would say as you mentioned too, even if you're not a birder and you happen to be going, down that way or coming the way, it's worth just taking a few minutes to take that, take that turn and go up to Fort Hill just to experience that view because it really is absolutely fabulous. I got an email from Lisa in Plymouth, and she says, I'm a big fan of the bird programs on WCAI, but could Mark take a few minutes to talk about sea turtles? Many people are unaware that several species of sea turtles can be found in the waters around Cape Cod. Also, please explain the annual stranding event that will soon be upon us and the related cold stun condition.
Sure. Oh, that one
That's a good
lobbed that
question. Yeah.
softball in there. Yeah, we're just gearing up now. That's a great question, and it's a good time to give reminders about our sea turtle program and what to do. And so this is the very beginning. Any day now, if the once the bay water temperature in Cape Cod Bay drops below 50, and usually a little bit before then, cold stunned juvenile sea turtles, mostly Kemp's Ridley sea turtles, which bizarrely is like the most endangered sea turtle in the world. And then later on in the season, loggerheads, also some green sea turtles. Those are the three species. The juveniles of those species are out in the bay right now, unbeknownst to most of us. And they start cold stunning once the temperature drops. So they just become unable to really move around. And then we start getting more storms with northerly winds this time of year. And so as they lose the ability to swim and those winds blow them ashore on the high tides, but as we're learning more and more on all the tides, they drop out. And so we organized this sort of massive logistics effort where mostly volunteers, but also our staff are going out looking for these turtles. We're watching the weather, looking at the winds. And it's basically the bayside beaches between Sandy Neck and Barnstable and Provincetown, mostly Dennis to Truro. That's kind of the hot zone most years. If you get an anomalous year with more easterly component to the winds, then Sandy Neck will get more. But anyway, it's those bayside beaches, and we've got people out walking. Our staff, we're all staffed up. We've got a great crew of returning biologists. Our sanctuary director emeritus, Bob Prescott, is this is his program going back to the late 70s, really. And then Karen Dordeville is running the program, and then we have some good young biologists. And then just organizing all of these dedicated volunteers. We do an official training. If you're an official volunteer, you know it. But really, other people are out walking the beaches, and it's important for them to know what to do. And so we post signs at all the beach entrances that if you find a sea turtle, you get it up high on the beach, you cover it with seaweed to protect it from the wind, and you mark it prominently with the beach trash that's usually around in stormy weather. And you call us and you give us good directions to where it is, like the right direction from the landing and distance, and is very helpful for us. And then our staff will come get it. Or there are some cases where people can bring them to us under certain circumstances, if we're really getting slammed. And so Several years ago, we had a year that kind of put us on notice where we had 1,200 turtles, and it just, we had never seen anything like that. We were unprepared for it. It shut us down. The New England Aquarium is where these turtles go. That's our important partner on this. The New England Aquarium and the National Marine Life Center is where the turtles end up to be rehabbed. And so we're the first responders, collecting the initial data, running the logistics, the communications, and then we get them up there and they take care of it. But so ever since that year, we've been prepared and we were all staffed up. Last year, we had pretty close to a record with over 1,000 turtles again, but it was like it felt easy, right? Because we're
Yeah, because you got a staff.
staffed up and we've got it. The crew does such a good job now. So if
Yeah.
anybody finds them, it probably might be a couple of weeks before they really start coming in, a week or a couple of weeks. Once it starts getting colder and the water temperature drops, we'll start seeing those.
And we should say, a lot of times they look dead, right? So when somebody, if you find a turtle, you think it's dead, don't assume it's dead because it may not be. And it's tough to tell sometimes, right?
That's right. That's not your job, right? We can't even tell. It's just turtles are
Yeah, they look
turtles
bad,
are
but they're
barely
not.
alive as
Yeah.
it is. Turtles are barely
Yeah.
alive on a good day. You know, I'm just kidding. Turtles are one of my
No, but
first loves, but you cannot tell. They become hypothermic. Their metabolism drops. Their heartbeat is super slow. And we get these turtles where we think it's dead, and then it's flopping around on the floor 10 minutes later.
yeah,
And
you
so,
like it thaws out or
right.
something in that yeah. So
Right. I mean,
don't assume. Yeah. Yeah.
just cover it up and follow the call us. There's a hotline number on the beach signs. It's the sanctuary number and then an extension if you don't get a live person. So that's really
And you'll
your
take it from
that's your
there.
responsibility.
All right, got it. We're talking with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Aaron in Rochester writes, love your show. Mark Faraday is my favorite guest. I could listen to him talk for hours about birds, but I have a feeling if his topic was paper bags, he would make it just as captivating. She apparently liked your comments of progressive parenting, males taking care of young and harassing again. It. So thanks, Aaron, for
Stop, stop. I'm blushing. I'm
that.
going to get a swelled
Yeah.
head.
So you sent a really interesting video of this puffin and peregrine kind of drama. I guess the peregrine
Oh, my
falcon
Lord.
and a gull both wanted this poor little puffin. What the heck was going on there?
Right. So there's a long time, the dean of Cape Cod birding named Blair Nicola. And he goes up to Race Point all the time. I mean, he really puts in his time up there. And a lot of what we know about seabirds at Race Point has come from Blair over the decades. And he was up there recently, and he had a really rare sighting of a puffin, an Atlantic puffin, which are very rare on the Cape, just standing on the beach. And so then, you know, that's a situation where you would need to get it to wild care. That's just not, you know, something's wrong with the puffin. And so, as he's looking at this puffin standing on the beach at the base of the dune out at Race Point, a peregrine sort of took care of the situation. A peregrine falcon came in, probably saw it from a mile away, like, "Hey, injured bird, let me go have breakfast." And so this peregrine comes in and just pounces on this poor puffin, and he sort of dispatches it pretty quickly. At the neck area, as they do, falcons have a kind of a hooked bill with a little notch in it that they use to great effect to quickly dispatch their victims. And then another battle began when a great blackback gull wanted the puffin, and so the peregrine is now trying to fend off the great blackback gull. So this is the kind of Wild America moment that you can have if you make the effort to get out to places like Race Point in Provincetown. And Blair, in his eBird, you know, "I don't get out that much anymore with two kids under four," you know, and a full-time job and all that stuff. And so I'm not getting out there. And so I read stuff like I read Blair's lists and other people's lists and say, oh, that would be nice to get out there. And so I'm reading his eBird list. Live vicariously through. And the great thing about eBird is, you know, you can get the rare birds emailed right to you. And then in the checklist is this saga. You know, he's got the photos, like point blank, beautiful photos in his checklist from that day of the peregrine on the puffin and the great blackback gull. And he, you know, he wrote the story in the comments. And it's just the kind of amazing things that that can happen at any time here on the Cape if you're out, you know, looking for stuff. Sometimes stuff comes to you in really interesting things.
Wild. Yeah. All right, so we got an email from Amy in Falmouth. A screech owl has taken up residence in our nesting box. When do they mate, and would the male and female both tend the nest? It's been fun to watch the owl right after sunset when he's at the opening of the box getting ready to start the day.
Oh, lucky you. Yeah, I finally got some activity in my screech owl box last year. I just got a roosting bird and then a lonely male. I feel like they were star-crossed lovers, like they weren't there together at the right time, and so nothing ever happened. But yeah, you can't infer much now in terms of breeding. They're always in a cavity year round. It may, but just keep an eye on it. They don't breed until spring. They're not like the great horned owls that start breeding in February. But it's a good start. Right. You always want an owl in your box. You don't want gray squirrels. I tapped on one of my small bluebird boxes yesterday. I was kind of overdue to check on who was in the bird boxes. And a flying squirrel came out. And I've never had a problem with flying squirrels, so I have the luxury of still thinking they're cute. And boy, are they cute. Like, I haven't had them in my attic. Cute. You know, they get into people's attics and things. And so I was able to get I was able to get really nice photos of it. It just kind of like clung to the side of the tree right in the middle of the day. I couldn't get Beckett to come look at it. He just wouldn't push away from his trucks, his beloved trucks. I feel like I'm losing him. Losing him, Mindy.
Just for a while. He'll get over that.
But anyway, so you never know what's going to be in your boxes, but hopefully it's an owl. But if not, maybe a flying squirrel.
So if the screech owl does decide to mate in that box, will the male and female tend to the nest?
There was a part two to the question.
Yeah.
I should have used that time to Google that. I'm trying to remember parental care in screech owls. I think they're both involved in definitely the prey sort of feeding. It may be that I would guess that the females do most of the incubating and the males do hunting. But geez, I'm caught flat-footed on that one.
Okay, that's okay.
There's an amazing amount of variability, right, in terms of the life history strategies of different birds in terms of parental care, like more than you would think. Even within closely related species, you'll have very different parental care. But that's one I need to look
at. All right. So you mentioned great horned owls, and I have been hearing couple of great horned owls for at least the last week or so. And I happened to let the dog out at 4 a.m. this morning. Usually she doesn't go out that early, but today she did. And I could hear them. I was like, oh, well, see, this is my reward for coming outside at 4 a.m.
Yeah.
So is this where they're this time where they're searching for a mate?
Yeah. It's a little early. Yes. Yes, it is. And so as it gets towards winter, they'll be pairing up. And like I said, they breed so early, you know, January, February, they're starting to nest because they have a long nesting cycle. These big raptors, you know, ospreys come back in March because they have a long nesting cycle. Bald eagles start nesting in February. And so they need to start when it's cold. And so they're incubating their eggs when it's very cold. That you'll hear them maybe duetting back and forth around this time of year. They'll call, you know, year round to some extent, but yeah, they'll be getting pretty vocal as they're starting to pair up now.
Yeah,
I haven't been hearing them at my house. Maybe it's because I'm not out at 4 a.m.
Jenny says she heard an owl early this morning, a barred owl. Who cooks for you?
Oh, a barred owl.
Bardo, sorry.
Yeah.
I love
imitating
them. Yeah, that was actually pretty good. So when do they start breeding. Are they a spring breeder too, or?
Later than the Great Horned. So that's sort of special to your area. That's a recent colonist of the Cape, a recent wash ashore, the barred owl. And so they got a foothold in the Falmouth Mashpee area, and they seem to be moving west or east. There were some in Harwich. I don't know if they're still there. I think that seems to be as far. Maybe they've gotten to Brewster, but they're on their way. This is a species with a history of marching into new territories. The barred owl, I love barred owls, but in the Pacific Northwest, they're almost considered a pest because they're more generalist than the endangered spotted owls, which they're almost identical to. They're sister species. And they're more aggressive than the spotted owls, and they're sort of pushing them out of areas and places like that. So barred owls are very, sort of a generalist. They're really common in swampy woods in Florida and Maine and New Ham, just the big forests of Maine and New Hampshire. So they can breed just about anywhere. And they, as our forests are getting bigger, and certainly there are bigger forests on the Upper Cape there, they're going to be getting more and more common. And they've become common down Falmouth, Mashpee way.
So, how big do they get, and what are they generally after? Are they after like small like voles and things, or do they go as big as rabbits? What do they hunt?
They eat anything.
Anything.
There was a study in urban, I think Richmond, somewhere in South Carolina, I think, by Rob Beauregard. I'm trying to remember where he did this work, but it was in the city basically. They had them nesting in boxes, and they found that they were eating a lot of songbirds that were trying to sleep. They would just go out at
Oh
night and
no.
find the songbirds that were sleeping, and just they were eating them. Owls will eat anything that moves that they can catch. There's some amount of specialization, like some snowy owls specialize on ducks and others focus on mammals. But really, in general, they'll eat any hawk or owl will eat anything that moves. And if they, probably young rabbits, I don't know if they could, they're sort of in between a screech owl and a great horned owl in size. They're a good size owl, but I don't know if they could take a full size rabbit. That's a
Okay,
good question.
just curious. All right. Hillary says, I've been having a northern saw-whet owl call come up on my Merlin Sound ID app this past summer and fall.
Oh.
I read that they are migratory birds. Are they found on the Cape year-round? Thank you so much. You guys are the best. Thanks, Hillary. What about that? Are the saw-whet owls here all year, or just in the spring and summer and fall, maybe?
They are here year-round. It's so the Cape was always included as the southernmost coastal breeding area for northern saw-whet owls, which are pretty northern. They're truly northern. They do get south of us in the mountains and the Appalachians, Appalachians. But they're more of a boreal forest species. The kind of cool coniferous forest belt is where they are most common, and then they migrate south in the winter. Start, like November. This is migration time for northern saw-whet owls, and there are banding stations where they specifically focus on catching and banding northern saw-whet owls across the northeast. And so this is that time. But they do breed here, and I think they definitely breed in Falmouth, and they breed in Truro, and so different places, kind of swampy coniferous areas. You can expect them to breed, but not commonly. Nowhere near as common as screech owls and great horned owls. But anyone who you're getting them in the summer, you're lucky. That's a
And
real
some of the
treat.
and if hiking on the trails and things, looking down sometimes is a good thing, because if you see some of these rabbit pellets, I mean, this was several years ago where we had a friend who identified some pellets on the ground, and you look up in this tree and you see this little saw-whet owl that it was so cute. I mean, it looked like a stuffed animal, was so cute.
Oh yeah,
But
it's a pocket
yeah, I mean,
owl.
yeah, they're so tiny. I mean, they're adorable. But you can sometimes it's just fun to find, the owl pellets and see what it's been eating. I know you've done that with Beckett, where you kind of take it apart.
Yes. We Beckett and I had the opportunity to be under one of the barn owl boxes on Nantucket the other day. I was out there for the Nantucket Biodiversity Conference, and I was so happy to get out there. I hadn't been out there in years, like since before Beckett was born. And so we're looking at all these bones. The box wasn't occupied. You could tell these were all old. But we're trying to figure out, like, is that a squirrel? You know, there are no chipmunks over there. You know, you have to kind of think about where you are. But that's always a fun thing to do. I love looking at pellets.
Yeah. All right. So you were on Nantucket, and what was happening with the gulls? There's a big gathering. What's going on? Did the gulls come to the conference as well? What's happening?
Yeah, all the boys and gulls were there. Yeah, sorry. Here the radio's turning off. So th this was the Nantucket Biodiversity Conference, which I ha haven't been to in a while. They do a great job. There's so many conservation organizations over there, just so many people doing good work. It's a very special place over there, a special community. And so I was speaking at the conference, and it was great. And then I was very lucky to be put up out at Squam Farms, a gorgeous Nantucket Conservation Foundation property out there. Just fantastic. But then I'm starting to hear from the locals, and I have it in my head, like, there's always a great gull show at the at Sconset or Low Beach, kind of around the corner. But I don't get, you know, I'm not a local out there. I just assume there's always lots of gulls. I see the reports of big numbers of gulls, but it's not consistently like that. And so all of the locals were buzzing about how many gulls were amassed off the east, along the east side, just right along the beach, along the whole east side of the island, basically. And we went, I took the kids over to one of these beaches, and the air is just full of gulls in every direction, out, left, right, you know, as far as you can see. And it's just different than other places. Like, one of the most common gulls is a European species called the lesser blackback gull. There's nowhere else you can go, maybe in the Northeast, and expect to see that many of this basically European gull, a lesser blackback gull. But you look at in Nantucket, you go to the east side of Nantucket, and it can be one of the most common gulls. And kittiwakes, thousands of black-legged kittiwakes, probably, if you were able to really see and tally everything. And that was really unusual. And so the local birding community was sort of buzzing about this gull show. And as I was bumping into people, they're like, "Have you seen the gull show? Go to the gull show." And so we went and checked it out. And they seemed to be eating sand lances, those kind of long fish, the same things that the whales are eating, and the terns and everything else. And it was just gulls. I had eight species of gulls in two quick visits to the beaches there. Who can name eight species of gulls quick?
Right. No, I
Somebody
can't. I don't think
just
I can. I had to think about
yes.
that. Yeah.
Obscure, you know, ones that people aren't as familiar with, like Iceland and Bonaparte's and kittiwakes and lesser blackbacked and that kind of thing, in addition to the common ones. So it was really cool. And gulls are not something that your backyard birder average person gets very excited about. Like, this is not very titillating for people. Oh, lots of gulls. Yeah, I got a
How
thing. So
exciting.
I'm
Yeah.
I would
Well,
yeah I gotta wash my hair. But birders love gulls. Most do, not everybody. There's like
I
a
like
there,
the
there's
my favorite's the laughing gull, but they're gone now, right?
like a there were some left. Yeah,
There was?
I saw a
Wow.
couple of
Okay.
there were definitely some laughing gulls mixed in.
I love those.
It helped get me up to eight species. But yeah, your average person is not that into gulls. But there's this like subspecies of birders, these gull fanatics who just can't get enough. And some of them you can barely identify, if at all. You basically
Yeah.
need genetic material to identify some of the immature gulls. But you know, everybody out there was excited just to see so many kittiwakes and just so many gulls in one place. It's not clear why, you know, what's going on. Congregation of bait fish there.
All right.
Seems
So
to be the obvious answer, but that was really nice to see. It was nice to get over there. It was nice to take in the
yeah.
gull show and see all the people over there.
So since you're talking gulls, we'll mention, because a lot of people don't know this, there is no such thing, no such species as a seagull, right? We say here seagull all the time, but that's not a species, right?
Oh, now you're sounding pedantic, Mindy.
I
You
didn't mean to
birders
say it, but
are so pedantic. Yeah,
it's
and
something
all
I
of
never
us.
realized, I mean, until I
Yeah.
started learning about birds, but I think a lot of people have that, misconception.
So what that is, that's a phase that all birders go through as you're developing as a birder. You go through the phase where you tell people, you know, there's no such thing as a seagull. And then
Then
you
you
sort of move
stop.
on. You just like I don't I my kid I say seagull to my kids. Like, it doesn't
Oh, you
matter.
do. Okay. Yeah.
It would
See,
sea,
oh,
ocean, whatever. But so that
you know
yes,
what?
there are And it's an opportunity. What it is an opportunity for sort of like an intermediate birder to point out to people that gulls nest in fresh water all across the interior of the continent. Like there are species of gull that don't nest at all in salt water. Franklin's gull. It's not something you would see around here, but you know, they're nesting in freshwater pond and marsh complexes across the interior of North America and then migrating south in these big sinuous flocks. You know, ring-billed gulls are nest one of the common parking lot gulls around here. They don't nest on Cape Cod at all. They're here year round, but they don't nest here. The ones that come here are probably nesting up on the St. Lawrence River somewhere in, you know, Quebec or something. And so, yeah, I mean, gulls are all over the place, freshwater, saltwater. And so people take that as a kind of a teachable moment about gulls, that they're not just on the ocean.
Well, I have to say, when I'm reading stories to my grandson, it says seagull. I skip the sea. I just say, and the gull.
Oh, I go a little nuts with the biological accuracy in the kids' books. You know, like, you know, Beckett, I know that this shows a polar bear next to a penguin, but they occur at opposite ends of the planet. You know.
So true, right? 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Lee in Harwich writes, we've heard an owl in our backyard around 3 or 4 a.m. Using the Merlin app, it identified it as a great horned owl. Is there, and indicated it was rare in this area. Any tips on how to locate a nest to keep a watch? That's a toughie.
I've heard a couple people say this about using Merlin. There's no way it would say great horned owl is rare around here. I think sometimes the eBird data is hyper specific to like a very small area, and so maybe none of your neighbors have reported a great horned owl, but they're very, very common. But I don't even know where to begin with Merlin. It's so incredible, this app, and I've given talks twice in the last week about these apps for birding, and just in the last year Merlin has added this sound ID based on their BirdNet technology. They finally mostly perfected automated identification of bird sounds in this area anyway. And I've tested it a few times and it's really like mind-blowingly good. So that it's finally here. People have been asking me for 15 years, like, when can I just hold my phone up and it tells me what bird is singing? And I was like, I don't know, be patient. It's very computationally difficult, but they figured it out. And so I'm excited to see more people doing this. And I think one of the good things about these apps, as I'm saying in these talks, is I think it's expanding the audience, getting more people identifying things, asking questions, and then hopefully interested in conservation and protecting all of these critters. I don't have good advice on finding a nest. You know, we're sort of protective of owl nests, but you know, sometimes you stumble across them and they're not particularly bothered by you. A lot of owls are not especially bothered. They're bothered by crows, but people walking under the nest. I mean, I remember a great horned owl nest that was right on Route 6A at the Museum of Natural History in Brewster, like just, you know, and they're the owls in their nest. So people kind of make too much of how prone to disturbance owls are at nests. But you don't, like a photographer, it is possible to disturb them. And so we're somewhat protective of them. But I really don't have great advice on finding the nest. I haven't had much luck except for some sort of obvious ones I've stumbled across. But it's going to be a stick nest up in a pine somewhere usually. Sometimes they're very obvious, like great horned owls are famous for nesting in great blue heron rookeries where they're just sitting in the open in an old beaver swamp with the dead standing trees as where the great blue herons tend to nest. And then you just see there's a great horned owl head kind of hunched down in one of the great blue heron nests, you know, 3 months before the great blue herons are going to come back and nest. But just keep looking.
Keep looking. All right. Doug says, I just heard Mark talking about what to do if you find a stranded turtle. One part was to leave good directions to the turtle. There's an app called What Three Words that lots of rescue organizations are using. It has created unique three-word names for every square meter on Earth and a location app that identifies the three words. For example, the entrance to the Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary is flooding.goes.futile. This could help people get to provide more precise locations of the turtles. That's interesting. Thanks for that info, Doug. Did you know about that?
It's not the first time somebody's told me about What Three Words. I haven't tried it out, but that's something we should circle back on. And I just want to, speaking of circling back, what were the three words? Is that some sort of like, that sounded like an omen. Yeah. Sea level rise is coming for us.
Flooding.goes.futile. I'll send you his email.
Futile?
So
that sounds really ominous. We better better move the buildings back now.
All right. Gail in Wacoite writes, I so enjoy this program. I'm missing the birds that came to my yard or passed through. My true visitors are five crows that stop at 8 a.m. Will the feeders bring birds back?
Geez, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, that's the idea. I don't. Yeah. Oh, is she saying like she doesn't have her feeders out still for some reason?
Maybe she doesn't have her feeders out. She just gets the crows. I think she's wanting to get more than just the crows.
Yeah. I can see that. I would want more than just the crows too. Yeah. I mean, certainly the feeder should be bringing in birds. I think mine are empty right now because we were away and I get lazy, but and we've got a lot of birds in our neighborhood all the time, but yeah, if you just put out some feeders, black oil sunflower seed, certainly this is the time of year, and the colder it gets, you see even more activity at your feeders.
Yeah. And then Amy sent a suggestion on books. She said with all the owl conversation, she's recommended this book for kids and adults alike. She says, wonderful images and great information. And the name of the book is Owling, Enter the World of the Mysterious Birds of the Night by Mark Wilson. And it's got the cover looks like it's got all kinds of pictures of cool owls. So thanks for that, Amy. Another question about eagles. Where do they go once the ospreys return?
Well, they're here before the ospreys, and then I assume you're talking about like if they occupy an old osprey nest.
I'm thinking
in some cases,
that's what she means, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they just wander around. They're failed breeders, and so it's very normal in bird nesting biology that failed breeders just have to go figure things out, and they go wander around, and you see this with ospreys. Sometimes they'll just their nest fails for whatever reason, and then they just go wander around. But it's definitely, by the time the ospreys are back, it's too late for bald eagles to go somewhere else and re-nest. And I think typically it's young birds, especially because we're not a core part of the bald eagle range. So I think the birds that are nesting here are attempting to nest here are first-time breeders. And so they're likely to get kicked out by the ospreys when the ospreys come back. Although in Wareham, some bald eagles did secure an osprey nest, and they had chicks last year. I was lucky enough to go view the banding of the chicks, where Eversource and the state biologist kind of came together, and it was in a power line right of way. So it can happen, and it will happen more and more in the coming years. I think that there'll be bald eagle nests that we know about, and the bald eagles might be able to take over the nest from the ospreys, and the ospreys will have to then figure out what to do. The ospreys can nest somewhere else if they come back and find a bald eagle in their nest. You know, that's going to be really early in their nesting cycle, so they can go somewhere else and nest. But for an eagle in April, you know, that's then too late to initiate another nest, so they're taking a year off.
Yeah. All right. Joe in West Harwich says, a few years ago, I was in Hyannis at the Trader Joe's commercial complex, and I saw a juvenile gull in the back parking lot. It hadn't fledged and was taking evasive action on the ground while adults seemed to be diving on people in a protective manner. Seems like the gulls may have been nesting on the roof of the building. Also, I like to park at Pleasant Road Beach and drink my tea on weekend mornings. Three times in recent weeks, a gull has come over to my car and started pecking on my vehicle. What's up with that?
Well, what's up with that is people are feeding the gulls at the parking lot. But the so what? When was this?
He says a few years ago. He doesn't say what time of year. You mean when the gull hadn't fledged yet? Yeah.
It was a few. So, but what time of year and where was it again? Yes. My wife can tell it was, you. I'm not a very good listener.
It was at the Trader Joe's complex in Hyannis.
Because
we know they're on the Cape roof of the Cape Cod Mall, so that makes sense that they. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, roof nesting seabirds, gulls. There are even terns, even like federally endangered, like roseate terns. Least terns are famous for nesting on the roofs of all the strip malls in Florida. That's a thing. And so, yeah, I'm sure that was a fledgling. There's kind of a long fledgling period for gulls where they're annoying the adults and begging for food all the time. And so, yeah, you see them late summer into early fall, these young gulls still annoying the adults. And sometimes the adults will beat up on them.
Yeah. And, you know, this is another good reason to not feed the gulls, right? I mean, pecking on the cars, but also on the beach. I mean, they'll come up, they're brazen, right? They'll just take stuff right out of your hand. If, you know, with some of the like little kids, the gull just come up and take that sandwich away.
Yes. Yeah. So does my daughter. I call my 1-year-old Phoebe. I call her a seagull. When we're at the beach, I've seen her do it. I've seen her take a sandwich right out of another kid's hand. We have to watch her. This is my daughter, the seagull. Sorry.
She's hungry. Yeah. Yeah. Aaron wrote back to say, thank you for telling us about BirdNet. I have shared this with many curious folks and also uploaded recordings to their database from our bird-rich tall pines in Rochester. Aaron, thanks for that.
Yeah.
So I don't have anything else on my list. So maybe we could talk a little bit about, I know you've mentioned this before, but people who are wanting to learn a little bit more about what birds there are. I know we've been trying to, when we're walking in the woods, we're listening, trying to listen more for birds than seeing them, because we actually don't always see them, but you hear them. So maybe some thoughts on how people can learn to identify birds by listening.
Sure. And so we talked about this new era of being able to use the Merlin app and BirdNet to identify what you're hearing around you. And so, you know, if you're just getting into it now, you're coming into a golden time. You know, we didn't have that. We didn't have that in my day, we didn't have these fancy apps. And so I hope that people will start the old fashioned way with just listening and then tracking things down and getting eyes on them. That's the only way you can ground truth the results of the app. You can't take it at face value. It's very good. I mean, it really, but I'm testing it already knowing what the bird is that's singing or calling. And so I'm just out there kind of ground truthing it. But, you know, if you're just getting started, you're like, okay, it said it's this. But how do you know? You have to, you know, use your feet. You have to walk, find the sound. And that's how you learn. Getting eyes on the whatever the bird is that made the sound. And it's a slow process and driven by an interest in learning more of tracking things down. And that's how you internalize things. I always tell people, you know, the bird books always have these mnemonics, you know, the Phoebe says, the chickadee says Phoebe or whatever it says, you know, tea kettle, tea kettle, tea kettle for Carolina wrens. Come up with your own. Like sing back to the bird, come up with your own mnemonic in your head. Just personalize it to yourself. You don't have to rely on them. I've never liked the mnemonics. They never sound right to me. And so I always kind of make up my own, but that's really it. And, you know, do it year round, start with the common things in your yard, certainly use the app to help you. And if it, you know, gets you outside listening, that's the probably the biggest benefit of these apps, and just keep at it. Yeah, oh, and there's a, I just wanted to quickly mention, there's an app called LarkWire that I always promote in my, we were talking about it last night at Cape Cod Bird Club. It was some question about whether it's available for Android phones. It's definitely available for iPhones for many years, and it's called LarkWire, and it's like a game, and it's, they show pictures of four birds and they play a song and then you tap on the one you think it is. And you can choose beginner, intermediate, advanced, whatever, and just play this game. You can also use it to look up songs.
I love it. So it's called LarkWire?
It's called LarkWire, and so the and it keeps track of your progress, and it'll keep throwing birds at you that you're having trouble, or groups of birds. You know, it does it by groups, like warblers that sound like squeaky wheels, like blackpoll warbler and some of the other boreal warblers. That's one of the groups that I sometimes struggle with. But yeah, it's a fun. Just the fact that it's a game and it keeps track of your progress is very engaging. Kind of way to learn bird song that I recommend.
Yeah, I'm gonna definitely check that out because, as you know, I've got my little 6-year-old birder here who's brings his binoculars whenever we go out for a walk in the park. We go out in the woods for sure, he does. But I'm amazed even already at the sounds he knows. We were walking in the park with the dog the other day, and he said, "Oh, I hear a blue jay." And sure enough, of course, a blue jay is pretty easy to identify. But
Yes.
that's a good idea to start with in your yard. I mean, if you're just kind of out in the garden or you're hanging out in the yard, you can see what's making that sound. And that's a good way, especially with kids, to sort of get started, right?
This is going to sound braggy, but Beckett identified his first titmouse by ear
Ooh, wow.
before he was two. He was just sitting in the stroller having a snack, and he just looked out and he went, "Tufted, he and titmouse." And then he went back to eating his crackers or whatever. And Phoebe, I guess Emily saw it first, but when I was at a conservation area in Orleans the other day, Phoebe, there were a bunch of chickadees that I was kind of paying attention to, and Phoebe walks in and starts going chickadee dee dee, and so
Wow.
she's 21 months, and so that was her first identification by ear. I was very proud
Yeah,
moment.
you might have a couple of little birders on your hand. I'll
Well,
be
yeah.
curious to hear what they're. As my grandson's best bird, ask them what their
Yeah.
best bird is, Mark. That would be interesting.
Best bird. Yeah, I'll try
What's your
not to be
best?
like the birding version of the agro sports dad. You will identify the bird. Yeah. Get in
Yeah,
there.
that might
Yeah.
turn them off. Exactly.
I'll try not to do that.
Mark Faraday joins us the second Tuesday of the month to talk about birds and other critters we find on the Cape and Islands. Mark, as always, thanks for being with us.
No problem.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.